2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 222. Could Joseph Smith have written the Book of Mormon? Part 3. Is the Book of Mormon a product of automatic writing? A paper presented by Robert A. Rees with a response by Dan Weatherspoon.
Good morning. If everyone could take a seat, we will begin. On behalf of Sunstone and this morning's presenters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for attending. This is session 222, Could Joseph Smith Have Written the Book of Mormon? Part 3, Is the Book of Mormon a Product of Automatic Writing? I am to remind you that Sunstone is on an honor system, so please have a ticket or a prepaid admission for this. Also, please turn off or put on vibrate any cell phones or pagers so that the speakers or the audience is not interrupted. I'm in an envious position because I'm able to introduce two speakers who are very well known to Sunstone. It's also enviable because I'm able to tell them to sit down and be quiet, and if that arises. The paper is written by Robert Rees. Robert Rees is the Director of Education and Humanities at the Institute of Heart Math in Boulder Creek. He taught at UCLA for 25 years. He is a former editor of Dialogue and former chair of the Sunstone Board. He has a BA from BYU and an MA and a PhD from the University of Wisconsin. Dan Weatherspoon is originally from California, first Sacramento and then San Diego. He served an LDS mission in Seattle and following that taught at the MTC for 2.5 years. He has a BA in philosophy from BYU, an MA in religious studies from Arizona State University, and a PhD in religion from Claremont Graduate University. He's been the editor of Sunstone since January 2001 and executive director since November 2001. He's married. His wife, Lori, have two children, Alex and Hope. Please join me in welcoming our speakers, and Robert Rees will begin, then Dan, and we will have questions afterwards.
This is the third paper I've written which addresses the question, could Joseph Smith have written the Book of Mormon? In two earlier papers, Joseph Smith, The Book of Mormon and the American Renaissance, which was published in a recent issue of Dialogue, and Irony in the Book of Mormon, which will be published in the fall issue of the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies, I have argued that the complex narrative structure, the sophisticated literary style, and the presence of esoteric material unknown and even unknowable to Joseph Smith disqualify him as a candidate for the book's author. Having exhausted the more bizarre and Byzantine explanations of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, naturalist critics have postulated what appears to be a more rational explanation. It was the product of automatic writing. That is, by some mysterious process, psychic forces, angelic voices, discarnate personalities, goddesses of wisdom, dictate a rapid and voluminous flow of words that somehow turn out to be coherent, inspiring, and often amazing in their brilliance and inclusion of esoteric facts, some of which are beyond the author's knowledge. In this paper, I examine the proposition that the Book of Mormon can be explained as a product of automatic writing. Automatic writing, also called spirit writing, psychography, abnormal writing, direct writing, and independent writing, is a form of writing the source of which supposedly comes from outside the conscious or subconscious mind of the person receiving the communication. That is, the quote-unquote author is merely a conduit for some other intelligence, an amanuensis for someone else's ideas and expressions. One of the problems with exploring this phenomenon is that it seems to cover such a wide array of experiences. Thus, some of the conduits of communications from some other realm use Ouija boards on which the communication is spelled out letter by letter, crystals or stones in which words and sentences appear, or merely listen to, see, or understand the messages being sent, sometimes in visions, dreams, or in trance states. The scribes for these communications may use a pen, a typewriter, or a computer to quickly write down, sometimes using shorthand, what is being dictated or revealed, or may dictate the messages to a recorder. Some communications take place during a single period with a flurry of language. Others, like the famous A Course in Miracles and the Urantia book, take place over a period of years. Complicating the matter is the communications come from a wide and strange array of personalities. These include such historic figures as William James and Oscar Wilde, unknown personalities such as Patience Worth, a 17th century Englishwoman, creatures from other planets such as Orontan, divine counselor, chief of the corps of super universe personalities who revealed the Urantia or Earth Chronicles, previously unknown prophets from the past such as Tachamenon, Seth and Levi, and even Jesus Christ. Skeptics of scientific psychic experiences, including automatic writing, tend to explain such phenomena as clever frauds, unconscious processes, or disassociation, which the dictionary defines as, quote, the separation of whole segments of the personality, as in multiple personality, or of discrete mental processes, such as in schizophrenias, from the mainstream of consciousness or behavior. In other words, these communications are produced as conscious deceptions, unconscious delusions, or subconscious dissociations. While I believe that some such phenomena can be so explained, I am convinced that not all can be. What does one make, for example, of the cases in which the person communicating from beyond the veil begins conversing in a language unknown to the medium or scribe, but which the scribe records with linguistic precision? There are also instances in which the medium, who is the conduit of the automatic writing, performed tasks that are impossible to explain as a result of conscious, unconscious, or subconscious processes. That is, they receive historical facts and use linguistic styles that were not available in their information environment. And they express them in language and forms that were far beyond their expressive talents. One of the most intriguing and most widely studied automatic writers was Pearl Curran, a St. Louis, Missouri housewife who, over a 10-year period, received an enormous volume of material, history, prose, poetry, proverbs, prayers, etc., from a spirit personage who identified herself as Patience Worth, a Quaker who had lived in 17th century England. What, if anything, does all of this have to do with the Book of Mormon? In an article entitled Automaticity and the Dictation of the Book of Mormon, Scott Dunn argues that the Book of Mormon is an example of automatic writing. He contends that, quote, a number of parallels exist between Joseph Smith's production of Scripture and instances of automatic writing. He uses the case of Pearl Curran / Patience Worth to make his point. Mrs. Curran received communications from Patience Worth through use of a Ouija board, which she in turn dictated to various scribes. One of the most curious aspects of these communications is that they were given in, quote, an antique and archaic figurativeness, in an amalgam of dialects from earlier English periods, and in a diction that was 90% Anglo-Saxon, as compared with 42% for the Declaration of Independence. So much different than the conventional speaker of in the 1920s and 30s in St. Louis, Missouri. According to linguistic experts, it contained no modernisms. Over the decade of these communications, Curran was the conduit for a voluminous body of work, including, as I've mentioned before, poetry and fiction. Those who knew her intimately and those who studied her carefully, including some of the leading psychologists and literary and linguistic scholars of the time, were convinced that there was nothing in Curran's background, in her study, or in her experience which could account for this material. Dunn compares Curran's experience to that of Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon. Quote, like believers in the Book of Mormon, followers of Patience Worth adduced linguistic evidence to show that the writing dictated to Pearl Curran did indeed belong to antiquity, although some of the language was more ungrammatical and archaic. There appears to be occasional uses of genuine obsolete English words which Curran could probably not have known. Another startling thing about the works attributed to Patience Worth is their accuracy on factual details that Curran could apparently not have known, a defense often applied to the writings given through Joseph Smith. Extending his argument, Dunn writes, quote, like Joseph Smith, Pearl Curran appears to have lacked the education necessary to produce such works. Just as Joseph Smith eventually began to dictate revelations without the aid of a seer stone, so Curran began to dictate the words of Patience Worth without any physical object. Curran simply saw the pictures and the words in her head and called them out as coming from the hand of Patience Worth. Pearl Curran is like Joseph Smith in still another way. For both, available evidence militates against the likelihood of conscious fraud. Dunn then asks, but beyond these general parallels to the experience of automatic writers, what is the evidence that Joseph Smith's translation is an example of this phenomenon? Dunn answers his own question. To begin with, the content of automatic texts is often similar to that of the Book of Mormon. Examples include multiple authorship, use of archaic language, accounts of bygone historical figures, accurate descriptions of times and places apparently unfamiliar to the writer, narratives with well-developed characters and plot, accounts of various ministries of Jesus Christ, poetics, occasionally impressive literary quality, doctrinal cosmological discussions, and even discourses by deity. Dunn also argues that the manner in which the Book of Mormon was produced, quote, bears strong resemblance to the process of automatic writing, including, quote, the speed and ease with which Smith worked on his translation. After countering the arguments of some critics who feel the Book of Mormon is not a good example of automatic writing, Dunn concludes, it is clear that Smith's translation experience fits comfortably within the larger world of scrying, channeling, and automatic writing. Indeed, the automatic process provides the best model for understanding the translation of the Book of Mormon. To what extent are Dunn's observations accurate? To begin with, if one takes all the texts which might fit into the category of automatic writing, a great number of books, many of which make no claim to have been written or dictated by anyone other than the author, might also said to have content similar to automatic texts. The fact is, the body of works identified as automatic texts have very little in common with one another. They range from the absurd to the inspired, from the mundane to the esoteric, from short story to voluminous chronicle, from realistic narrative to what could best be described as speculative fiction. And their styles are as various as their subject matter. So while it may be true that the Book of Mormon, quote, fits comfortably within the larger world of automatic writing, it also fits comfortably within the larger world of narrative fiction and within the narrower world of sacred literature. What is valid in Dunn's argument is that there are many similarities between the processes described by automatic writers and that described by Joseph Smith and his various stenographers of the Nephite history. That is, the nature of the translation process, receiving information from some source outside himself, seeing words through a seer stone, dictating a sort of stream of consciousness narrative, being able to pick up the dictation or translation after the possibility of automatic conveyance. Note, what did I miss here? Page 13. There it is. Okay. So, being able to pick up the dictation or translation after interruptions and delays with no break in the narrative flow, producing a large body of material over a short period of time, and leaving the final text essentially unrevised, all of these have similarities to the producers of some automatically written texts. But if one postulates that some automatic texts or some sacred literature really are the products of some communication beyond the veil, as I am convinced they are, then one would expect some correspondence between such texts and a text that the translator claimed to have been given to him by an angel, assisted in the translation of by the use of the Urim and Thummim, and inspired by the Holy Ghost. That is, if communications do come from the spirit world, it seems likely that they may come in different ways and for different purposes. I would argue that such a communication, which purports to be the scriptural record of ancient Israelites and a second testament of Jesus Christ, should make an unusual claim for our consideration. For those who believe that the veil between the mortal and immortal worlds is penetrable by those who have special gifts or sensitivities, it is not difficult to believe in the possibility of automatic conveyance of or inspired revealed translation of such material. That is, if Jehovah could reveal his law to Moses, and if Jesus could reveal to John the wild and wonderful things contained in the book of Revelation, certainly he could reveal the record of his New World peoples to Joseph Smith. How he would do so is less important than that he could do so. What evidence do we have that such communications from the spirit world actually take place? While I personally have reason to doubt the validity of some automatic texts, I contend that some automatic writing cannot be explained as a result of naturalistic influences or causes. Until recently, we have had to take such phenomena on faith, relying on subjective testimony, sometimes unreliable narrators, unverifiable accounts, possibly prejudiced witnesses, etc. That is, while some of the evidence marshaled in favor of such texts and such quote-unquote authors is impressive, and I believe impossible to explain away as a product of either deception or psychological processes, no studies have been conducted under the kind of rigorous scientific conditions that would provide conclusive evidence of communication from beyond the grave. That is, no studies have existed until recently. For the past decade, Dr. Gary Schwartz and Dr. Linda Russick have conducted a series of rigorous investigations into the existence and nature of the human spirit at their Human Energy Systems Laboratory at the University of Arizona. Dr. Schwartz has impeccable academic credentials, having received his PhD from Harvard and having served on the faculty of Harvard and Yale, where he was director of the Psychophysiology Center. He is the author of more than 400 scientific papers. In The Living Energy Universe, Dr. Schwartz and Dr. Russick present convincing evidence of what they call, quote, the universal living memory, suggesting that, quote, everything in the universe is alive, eternal, and evolving, that, quote, every idea, every thought, and every awareness ever generated is even now contained in the universe as information or memory, that consciousness survives death, and that God exists and, surprisingly, is evolving. An idea, by the way, argued in Eugene England's final and seminal essay on the weeping God of Mormonism. In his most recent book, The Afterlife Experiments, published last year, Schwartz reports on a number of experiments he and Dr. Russick conducted at the University of Arizona to try and determine whether people who have passed on can actually communicate with the living. Using established mediums, people who have a gift for spirit communication, whose integrity they had come to trust, Dr. Schwartz and Russick set up controlled laboratory experiments in which the mediums were asked to communicate with the spirit world on behalf of people whose identities they were ignorant. In one double-blind study, the mediums were asked to receive information about the subjects, who are called sitters, without seeing or hearing them speak. In other words, they knew nothing, including the age or gender of the people for whom they were to receive communication. In the sessions conducted under the supervision of Dr. Schwartz and Russick, mediums were able to identify a number of highly specific details about the person communicating from the spirit world and his or her relationship to the subject of the medium's intervention. In some instances, the mediums even conveyed information to the subject that the subject rejected as being true, only to discover later that indeed it was true. The accuracy of such information, again, is not the vague and general kind of information with which fake mediums gull their clients, but highly specific and individualistic data, such as the names of the deceased persons and others of their acquaintance, their personalities, their professions, the ways in which they died, people to whom they were related, experiences which they shared in mortality, etc. In one experiment, the mediums averaged an astonishing 83% accuracy rate as compared with 36% average for the control group. Dr. Schwartz concludes, the statistical probability of this difference occurring by chance alone was less than 1 in 10 million. Of their latest and most scientifically rigorous experiments, Dr. Schwartz reports, we performed statistical analyses indicating that the results could have occurred by chance fewer than 1 in 100 trillion times.
Dr. Schwartz and Russick evaluated their experiments in light of what they knew would be the criteria by which their work would be judged by their scholarly peers. Scrupulously, they considered ways in which their experiments might have been flawed or evaluated, including fraud, cueing, selective memory, vague information, lucky guesses, experimental biases, etc. In reviewing their experiments and evaluating them in light of their own high standards for scientific integrity, their own skeptical safeguards, and the challenges of non-believing critics, Dr. Schwartz concludes, quote, "I went through all the experiments, each and every one, each and every reading, both within and beyond the formal data collection periods, and examined it all on the basis of the 11 key summary points that form the core of the experiments. I can no longer ignore the data and dismiss the words. They are as real as the sun, the trees, and our television sets, which seem to pull pictures out of the air." His scientific conclusion, quote, "In the experiments, information was consistently retrieved that can best be explained as coming from living souls. The data appeared to be as valid, convincing, and living as the mediums, sitters, skeptics, and scientists themselves. That's what the experimental data unmistakably show." Related scientific studies on intuition conducted at the Institute of Heart Math in Boulder Creek, California, where I work, demonstrate that our physiological system has access to a field of information not bound by the laws of time and space. Dr. Roland McCrady, IHM's Director of Research, has conducted studies showing that the body, and especially the heart, can respond to a future prior event, to a future event prior to any knowledge of the event. I've seen these studies, and they're really quite fascinating. Dr. McCrady states, "I have no way of interpreting this phenomenon outside of a quantum context. That is, the kinds of phenomena that occur on a quantum level, such as time reversal and non-locality, also occur at the macroscopic level in the realm of the human heart and brain." McCrady adds, "This experiment suggests that some aspect of our perceptual apparatus is continually scanning the future." Given this new, and I believe compelling, scientific evidence, which confirms the validity of spirit communication, including the possibility that at least some of the cases of automatic writing might indeed be authentic communication from across the liminal threshold that divides the living and the dead, Joseph Smith's claim as to the source of the Book of Mormon and the process by which he translated it do not seem so outlandish. That is, if communications from the spirit world can produce even fragments of information, if texts can be written that cannot be explained as a result of naturalistic causes, then it surely must be possible for someone to be the conduit of a book as strange and as wonderful as the Book of Mormon. Having said that, I would like to illustrate ways in which I think the Book of Mormon does not fit the usual model of automatic writing. To begin with, other writers of automatic texts have been quite clear about the fact that their information comes from some personage, and they are clear as to the identities of those who are communicating through them. These spiritual dictators often have names, come from specific epochs, have definite personalities, Unlike these mediums of extramortal communication, Joseph Smith never claimed that anyone was dictating to or communicating through him. While he saw specific words, he does not identify them as coming from a specific source beyond the gold plates. Another way in which Joseph Smith's claim differs from the producers of automatic texts is that he is the only one of whom I am aware who claimed to have had an actual tangible text from which his dictation was derived. The gold plates revealed by Moroni and placed into Joseph's hands constitute the source of the record he claims to have translated, even though at times there was no direct or tangible connection between the dictation he received and the plates themselves. Also, Joseph Smith alone, as far as I can tell, is unique in including in his text information that was not available anywhere in his or anyone else's information environment during the time he produced his text. While Patience Worth spoke highly specialized English dialects and used archaic vocabulary that seemed impossible for her medium, Pearl Curran, to have known, the fact is such dialects and vocabulary were available in the English-speaking environment of certain districts in England. The same could be said of patients' worse use of topical information about the Holy Land in A Sorry Tale, her fictional narrative of Jesus. In contrast, the Book of Mormon contains information that, as far as can be determined, was not known to anyone in the world at the time it was published. For example, Eugene England pointed out several years ago that the route that Lehi and his people took across the Arabian desert was counter to what all the travel guides of the 19th century described or advised. England summarizes, "For Joseph Smith to have so well succeeded in producing over 20 unique details in the description of an ancient travel route through one of the least known areas of the world, all of which have been subsequently verified, requires extraordinary and reasonable faith in his natural genius or his ability to guess right in direct opposition to the prevailing knowledge of his time." Another example of material contained in the Book of Mormon and unknowable in 1830 is the vast amount of detail about Mesoamerica. As John Sorensen states, "At point after point, the scripture accurately reflects the culture and history of ancient Mesoamerica. Where did such information come from if not through Joseph Smith in the manner he claimed? Literally, no person in Joseph Smith's day could have known enough facts about exotic Central America to depict the subtle and accurate picture of life, ancient life, that we find as a background of the Book of Mormon." And Sorensen talks about such things as cultural history, language, Nephite political economy, elements of material culture, and warfare. Another example of information contained in the Book of Mormon that was unknown in 1829 are the inclusions of words, rhetorical practices, rituals, and cultural practices, the meaning of which has been discovered since 1830. One of the most unusual kinds of material one finds in the Book of Mormon is that which has an Egyptian origin. An example is a word such as Hermounts, found identified in Alma 2:37 as, quote, "that part of the wilderness which was infested by wild and ravenous beasts." As Hugh Nibley points out, this word is almost identical with Hermontus, a land named after the Egyptian god of wild things and wild places. And Gordon Thomason argues persuasively that the word Mormon itself, which is first presented in the Book of Mormon as a place infested by wild beasts, has the same root R-M-N, as Hermounts. Other Egyptian elements are the use of names Korihor, Paharam, and Pankai, the latter of which is a 7th century B.C. name that is contemporary with Lehi, not known in the West until the end of the 19th century. Another example is the word Nahom, the location where Nephi's people bury Ishmael and mourn his passing. As various scholars have pointed out, the word seems related not only to the Arabic root NHM, which means to sigh or to moan, suggesting grief, but also to a recently discovered ancient burial site, NEHAM, very close to the area where Ishmael was buried. Another interesting element that points to the Book of Mormon as an authentic text, an ancient text, is the fact that, as Gordon Thomason has pointed out, the older the text, the fewer the colors it contains. As you go back and look at the ancient text or look at modern text, the difference in colors is remarkable. Again, this was the Book of Mormon, the colors are restricted to black, gray, white, and red scarlet. Again, this was a characteristic of ancient texts unknown to Joseph Smith's day. And one would have expected, had Joseph Smith been the author of the Book of Mormon, that like other of his contemporary writers, he would have included many other colors from a broader palette. While some automatic texts claim to have been dictated by biblical figures and therefore have in common with the Book of Mormon the literary background of the Hebrew Scriptures, none comes close to matching the Book of Mormon's reflection of the complex rhetorical style and stylistic patterns of Hebrew literature, nor the deep familiarity with its theological or cultural characteristics. The Book of Mormon is replete with stylistic elements characteristic of Hebrew speech and thought patterns. If, as some critics contend, Joseph Smith somehow absorbed all of this or intuited it from his familiarity with the Hebrew Scriptures, keeping in mind that his mother said that he had not read the Bible through by the time he was 18 and that he was an indifferent reader, if he did this, he accomplished something no other author in the history of the world has. The sheer complexity of the Book of Mormon narrative is far beyond that of any automatic text of which I am aware. I could go into more detail about the complexity of that text, but I want to be respectful of the time that we need to allow for response and questions. I believe the evidence suggests that by some automatic writing, as well as the afterlife experiments of Gary Schwartz and Linda Russick, they present a compelling argument for the possibility of communication between the mortal and immortal worlds. As Schwartz says of his findings in testing his living soul hypothesis, quote, scientists and non-scientists alike are experiencing a test of faith. In this case, whether we can put our belief in the scientific method itself, because if we are to put our faith in the scientific method and trust the data that we have produced, what this data reveal, we are led to the hypothesis that the universe is more wondrous than imagined in our wildest dreams. All of the attempts to explain Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon by psychological methods are, I believe, flawed and ultimately unsuccessful. He is far more complex than the biographical critics or psychologists have been able to explain by their speculative analyses. As Harold Bloom says, at moments Joseph Smith appears larger than life in the mode of a Shakespearean character, so rich and varied a personality, so vital a spark of divinity, it is almost beyond the limits of the human as we normally construe those limits. It is important to emphasize that the material of the Book of Mormon came from some place. The mind and imagination of Joseph Smith, from some other writer or writers living in or before 1830, or from some other realm. And it had to come through some specific process or processes: imaginative creation, historical recording, inspired revelation or translation, or spirit dictation, as in the case of automatic writing. If it came from Joseph Smith's conscious or subconscious mind, it somehow had to have gotten there. As Caspar Yost observed about Pearl Curran, quote, the subconscious has a larger store of information than the conscious part of the mind, but it has no objective impressions that are not made through the senses. It knows nothing externally, that is to say, that it has not learned by seeing, hearing, touch, tasting, or smelling. No objective knowledge is in any part of Mrs. Kern's mind that has not been acquired through her own sensory experience. Perhaps Joseph's observation could be revised to read that the mind contains no objective terrestrial knowledge that has not been received through the senses. This leaves open the possibility that memory and knowledge may have some other locus of origin, such as pre-existent experiences, revealed dreams and visions, or some communication from the quantum or holographic sphere. The point is, if one contends, as do naturalist critics, that the rich tapestry of narrative we know as the Book of Mormon came from the mind and imagination of Joseph Smith, one has to account for the process by which it did so. No one, in my opinion, has offered a more satisfactory or more convincing explanation than the one Joseph Smith himself gave. Some naturalist critics speculate that all of the information contained in the Book of Mormon got there from Joseph Smith's 19th century environs. Citing the example of an automatic writer who apparently, quote, picked up and stored material that was in her field of vision as she worked a crossword puzzle, Scott Dunn says, it should not be surprising, therefore, to find Joseph Smith's scriptural productions repeating things he may have overheard in conversation, camp meetings, or other settings without any concerted study of these issues. That is, the subconscious mind simply hears things and stores them without the conscious mind being aware of it. Joseph Smith going to camp meetings, talking to people, ministers, etc., somehow pulled all this stuff in, and it came out as the Book of Mormon. And I say, Dunn or anyone else would be hard-pressed to show that anyone could have overheard the material, much of the material in the Book of Mormon in a camp meeting or any place else in Palmyra during the time that the Book of Mormon was published. The remarkable thing about the Book of Mormon is that there is not a single fact, character, or allusion that can be tied conclusively or exclusively to 19th century America. The parallels environmentalist critics find between the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith's cultural environment are of such a general nature that they could be found at many times and in many cultures. As Richard Bushman contends, the milieu of the Book of Mormon has much more in common with ancient Hebrew culture than 19th century America. He summarizes his analysis by saying that the Book of Mormon, quote, is strangely distant from the time and place of its publication. As a specialist in the literary history of the period out of which the Book of Mormon emerged, I can state categorically that it is unlike any book written in the entire scope of American literature. In conclusion, while I do not find the Book of Mormon a credible candidate as an automatic text, I believe it is more closely related to automatic writing than, say, normative narrative fiction, the former in some instances coming from someplace outside the author's mind and imagination. I believe that it is more closely related to automatic writing than, say, normative narrative fiction, the former, that is, automatic writing, coming from someplace outside the author's mind and imagination, and the latter coming entirely from within them. That is, on the basis of what I rationally accept as evidence, there seems to be supernatural forces at work in some written communications, automatic or otherwise. Just as I accept the fact that Pearl Curran could not be the author of the Patience Worth manuscripts and the communications recorded by Dr. Schwartz and Russick could not be the products of the mediums they engaged in their experiments, so I don't believe that Joseph Smith was or could have been the author of the Book of Mormon. Let me say just one word in closing. Sometimes some of the evidence that I've quoted here comes from a variety of sources. Sometimes people have said, this comes from farms or comes from someplace else. As a scholar, I really don't care where it comes from, whether it comes from the naturalistic critics or the farms critics or someplace in between. If it seems to me valid, credible, based on good scholarship and good science, it seems to me it is worthy of consideration, whatever its source. Thank you.
Bob Reese is to be commended for his now multi-year, multi-discipline project in trying to ask if Joseph Smith could have written the Book of Mormon, and for his willingness, as today's paper attests, to engage both Book of Mormon critics and defenders and to evaluate all kinds of evidences and explanations about the book's coming forth. Bob does not hide his voice, nor his reasoning. Unlike many who speak on the subject of the Book of Mormon that masks aspects of a larger agenda, I see no such veiling in Bob's work. He consistently identifies himself as a believer, but one who strives to be an informed one, and then proves it through his willingness to confront difficulties and to admit when certain non-typical theses or claims have merit. For these reasons and others, his thinking and writing about the Book of Mormon should be welcomed by all of us. That's the only part of my remarks that I wrote. And they're truly felt, but I wanted to make sure that I said those right up at the beginning. I don't think I'm going to take very long. Now, this was a technical paper, and I'm guessing that there's going to be some technical questions and things. What I'm hoping to do in the next, really probably only 7 or 8 minutes, is frame this just a little bit differently. I'm about to say something that I don't want to minimize the importance of this, but I don't know that there's a whole lot at stake in today's exact question. Once we are done today, if somebody thinks that the Book of Mormon is a channeled text or is still the product of automatic writing, or whether someone is convinced, as the way I think Bob, especially in the second half of his paper, as he's trying to take us to the evidence for communication across a veil, if they believe that's still viable, neither one of these is going to mitigate against the power of the Book of Mormon, the sacredness of the Book of Mormon, the transformative role that it has had in our lives, etc. And so I'm feeling okay about what's going to end up happening here at the end of my remarks. Is I'm going to try to say I think the automaticity thesis is still far more alive than Bob does. And I'm just going to try to convince you of that. But with that framing, I'm hoping that you won't sense that there's anything in making that claim that makes me want to minimize the power of the Book of Mormon. I'll talk a bit more about that when I respond to Jess Grossbeck this afternoon. But anyway, things at stake. but nothing that any of us should get really, really too hard about. Why did I choose myself as the head of this conference to respond to Bob's paper? I don't know if any of you remember, but in 2000, the year before I became the editor here, I kind of came out at Sunstone as a believer in the paranormal, as someone who'd come to study it, to basically believe a lot of phenomena that are known as the parapsychologist study, the word psi, you know, the Greek letter psi, PSI. Is kind of a name, and so if I throw that in there, I wanted you to know that I'm just talking here. I've come to do it, and sort of just my little journey that gets me there came really through a course I took during my doctoral work at Claremont. I've always had this desire to figure out the universe and to sort of get a sense at this sort of basic level how it works. And so this course was offered, and I said, you know, I ought to take that course just so I can know that as I'm framing the universe for myself and I'm trying to get oriented in what's going on, how much of this stuff do I have to take seriously? And, you know, do I need to sort of allow the data that parapsychologists and those who affirm psi are do I need to allow that in my worldview? Or are the critics and the things that are doing things? We had a wonderful course. We studied about a third of the course was exactly just purely on the methodological questions that are involved here. How do you study something that's pretty much always spontaneous? It's very rare that you can, I want an insight into what Helen is thinking right now, and I'm going to demand it right now. That doesn't happen, does it? And so psi and this deeper connection that sort of allows people to have access to information that doesn't come typically through the senses, it's very rarely can be done. We dealt with all the methodological problems. We dealt with the critics. We dealt with all the negative things as well as we dealt with all the affirming things. And so at the end of the course, I felt like we had a fair look. And I came probably to my affirming position, basically, a bit through a negative way and then a bit through the positive way. The negative, and this will hurt, and I guess in some way I'm trying to just say it ahead of time rather than have to come up during response. There was so much in the sensationist doctrine of perception, which is basically the mechanistic, that's the epistemology, the idea that we can only get information through our senses, through our experiences that come through those things. They couldn't affirm aspects of my life, my experience. I experienced myself as a free agent. And yet, ultimately, when you push comes to shove, if you allow that all these things in there, you can't, just the basics of freedom can't be done. It's impossible to escape solipsism. It's as if those who criticized and based upon this, you know, here's where they've put me. We can't know that this causes this, but I can't live my life without assuming that this event preceded this and this one caused this there. And so there was just this impoverished worldview to me that just wouldn't match my own experiences. And at the same time, I was really developing an ecological worldview, which is, as many of you know, is probably the big word that dominates that is interconnectedness. That the whole and the parts are intimately related to each other, that you just don't take small things and create a universe, but that there's causation that comes from the whole down on the parts, et cetera, things like that. And all these spiritualities that were sort of emerging in me, and I came across things like the holographic paradigm. I brought some books, the work of David Bohm and others who impressed me enough that I sort of said, I sense that there's something there that I can feel good about affirming my own experiences, that I have had an insight, or that rare moment as I've placed a hand on someone's head, or as I've chatted with them, where I've known what was at the core there. These sort of deep spiritual things I wanted whenever I played finally with the nuts and bolts of the universe. I wanted a universe that could affirm my experience. And so I've talked longer than I expected on that, but I came to pretty much feel pretty good about things paranormal. The shorthand. automatic writing and that particular aspect came to me through lots of things. I had also read Scott Dunn's piece in Sunstone. It's volume 10, number 6. I meant to bring a copy of its cover for you, but if anybody wants to get it, I think we still have a box back at the office, and I ought to bring some in today. But I'd read that. I'd been impressed with it. My sister had the Urantia book, one of the ones that he mentioned, influenced her life, and she'd given me that, and I'd been impressed with it. Through my own studies of religious studies, I'd always felt there's some kinship with the Quran and the Book of Mormon. These, you know, the Muhammad recite, the Quran is basically the recitation of Muhammad, and all the parallels there. And so I felt good that the Book of Mormon fell within this camp. Bob's paper deserves a very detailed response, but I just don't have time for it. And I know that you'll have questions for it. What Bob I think is ultimately trying to do, and it's an admirable thesis, and I'm not going to say that it's a dead thesis. Part of what I sensed he was doing today is saying, yes, there are parallels. Dunn, you got it right. All those others of you that have been thinking it, this business of picking up where he left off, and the words just flowing, and the quickness with which he did, and all the different methodologies, he's admitting that. But then he kind of wants to go on, and he wants to say, but the Book of Mormon's the best of all those, and it's actually gotten so much better than those that it's become unique. And therefore, I think that whereas maybe with Pearl Curran and the Patience Worth materials, that could have been sort of available through this wider psychic network or this web of interconnectedness and information that's out there, I think we need to go to the spirit world and somehow getting from this side of the veil to this side of the veil. And so that, to me, is what he seemed to be up to with his work with Schwartz. The people from Arizona. And things like that. And so he's just trying to push us there. All I'm going to say in hopefully 1 or 2 minutes without teaching the holographic universe is I'm not sure that that's a move we have to make. Given my understanding of what at least I'm sensing is a viable picture of the universe, everything that's ever happened, every thought that's ever held, every theme that's run through human history is available to us all. Just as God is aware of every sparrow, every lily, I believe we are too. We just aren't attuned to it at this moment because we're so busy thinking about what I'm wearing today and these things and staying alive and breathing and what, you know, Dan's, you know, impressing me, he's not impressing me. All these things are there. But truly, that information is available. David Bohm's thesis is basically that there's an explicate order and an implicate order. That the explicate order is this world that we see. But somehow or other, we're fundamentally implicate within this whole web is all the information in the entire universe. And so I can't argue for it because I haven't introduced it. You could get a little bit of the tape that I did in 2000 at Sunstone. I'd like to write it up as soon as I have a job that gives me some sleep and a decent chance to write, but I only can assert it, and I just wanted to say that I'm not positive we have to go to across the veil. My sense is that the universe is such, it's rich enough, the entire information of everything, true and false, is there. And that when we let ourselves down through prayer, through introspection, through meditation, just out of the blue sometimes, we can get access to that information. And I sense that Joseph Smith had powerful abilities in those ways, and I'm not positive we need to go with across the veil, at least with me at this point. The universe is rich enough, diverse enough, full enough, that he could have pulled out something very sacred, very important, and I don't deny that I want it to be God doing something absolutely unique. But at this point, I'm living my life happily and richly and fully, leaving that as an open question. Thank you.
appreciate Dan's thoughtful comments. I just wanted to clarify something. I did not intend to say that the Book of Mormon was better than these texts. I, in fact, find the Book of Miracles, your Rancher book, others of them, I think, have some profound truths in them. I know people who, I have friends who say, I have become a more loving person by taking the Course in Miracles. Something has happened to me through that. And so I didn't want to leave the impression that I was saying the Book of Mormon is good and true and these other things are not. I also didn't want to leave the impression that I believe, actually, in what Dan said, that Joseph Smith had access to that quantum holographic world in his translating the Book of Mormon, and that the veil is not, as we normally think of it, it can also be a veil between our insensitivity to that quantum holographic world rather than a veil between the spirit world and this world, whatever that world is. So I'm absolutely convinced that there is some way that we can penetrate those levels if we can become in tune and sensitive enough, but it certainly wasn't to make a judgment about other automatic texts.
We do have a few minutes for questions, so please come up here so that those that were foolish enough not to be here can enjoy the tapes.
I really just wanted to ask a question about, I was perplexed when you talked about information that Joseph had access to that was outside the mind and the imagination, because I've just never even thought of that. I don't know how we have access to anything outside of the mind and the imagination. I thought those are the creative and that's the way we perceive, you know, and I just don't know how something comes to us outside of the mind and the imagination.
It was perhaps misleading to say that. What I meant to say was that when Peter does not believe that the gospel should go to the Gentiles, I believe that Christ sends to him a dream that comes from outside of his experience, but obviously it's through his mind and imagination. Peter has to see those four corners. So it was not within his conscious, or it didn't originate from him, but obviously it comes through our minds and imaginations.
Please come up.
Well, it sounds to me like the question is, are we arriving at a point where science is beginning to move into a realm where we might be able to examine some of these psi or paranormal kinds of things? I believe from the institute where I work and from the work that we do with Dr. Schwartz and others, I believe that we are on the verge of that, and I hope at some point to be able to present a paper at Sunstone that might be the Book of Mormon and the quantum holographic model. I don't know. But it's fascinating work, and it seems, I mean, what Schwartz is saying is that so many scientists come up to the point of data which is conducted under strict and very rigorous scientific data, but if it doesn't comport with their own worldview, they can dismiss it. Well, I spent my life at a university knowing that that sometimes scholars are the most irrational people if things do not fit within their particular realm. And it is an openness to that. I really appreciate Dan's... again, if we are not open to the universe, it will never reveal itself to us. and there are yet many more wonderful and glorious things that we have yet to be revealed to us about the universe. Yes, one question here. What control group? They took a group of students at the University of Arizona. If you look at their book, The Afterlife Experiments, you'll see that these are very serious scientists. I mean, their reputations are on the line. Schwartz just received $3 million from the National Institute of Health to continue his studies. So there is some suggestion that this is serious work, and he certainly takes it seriously. There are others who are working in the same realm, but the thing that impressed me about their work is that they really have set up very rigorous scientific conditions under which they're, because they knew that if they weren't this, they would just be laughed out of town. So look at their book and look at the ways in which they set up their experiments, and I think you'll be impressed. Yes, Mark. A question that deserves another Sunstone Symposium session, but I think that they're probably they're as Dan said, the holographic world contains everything, the good and the bad. It contains fraudulent and true material. How we can access that and who has access to it and how they do it are still things we don't completely understand. I myself am skeptical of a lot of stuff that I read, maybe most of the stuff that I read that has to do with channeling, crystal gazing, those things. I am by nature and by academic training skeptical of all those things. But I'm also open to the possibilities that any of those things I might be persuaded. And so one would have to look at the specific kinds of things. But are there connections? Possibly. Yes, back here.
Right.
And how would, considering there's a very different model of Jesus Christ and the conceptualization of reality, where would you perhaps draw the line between objective reality and something that would be less long?
It's a great question. I'll try to get a little bit of the framing for the tape. I sell the tapes, you know. so we care about these things. We need the money. The Aquarian Gospel of Jesus Christ is a channeled text, which I guess you're saying has a different take on the universe than the Book of Mormon does. And Bob, I at least the version you gave me, you addressed that. You didn't in today, right? Okay, so Bob has kind of wrestled with that, and that was one of his evidences, or at least he was trying to argue that the Book of Mormon maybe doesn't fit this model, because you'd think that if it really came from a true spiritual source, they would all sort of agree, you know. And it is interesting to read the Seth materials and the, you know, the Aquarian Gospel and the Course in Miracles, and to see the place they disagree. So he was trying to argue, I guess, that what you're saying is troubled. Now you're asking me, how do I draw the line between the good and the bad and the ugly? And I don't know, other than, honestly, what I gave you is the clue for me about why the critical stuff against parapsychology didn't work for me, and that is, it's almost a pragmatic method. Does this resonate with how I live my life in such a way that I feel oriented, that I feel empowered to say that I am at home in this universe? And then if you were to take the pragmatic method very seriously, at those points where you say, my theory does not match my experience, and it gets so uncomfortable for with you. What I sense these critics do, or the ones who are still playing with the 18th century, you know, scientific model, is they make a choice. Okay, well, it seems like I feel like I'm free, but I'm really not, you know? And so this is the theory that they want to play with against the theory that lives their life. And I just have chosen that I want to interpret my spiritual experiences as spiritual in some way, whether it's God pushed a button, Dan, you got the information, or whether I let down my defenses enough and I felt a vibration in a cosmic web. I don't care. I tend to go that direction, but But anyway, that's my thought.
I think there are various ways to test. One of the tests for me is, does this text make me a more loving person? Does it lead me to be a better person? And it may come from a lot of different sources, but if it doesn't match that test, then for me, I'm not very interested in it.
I would just like to point out quickly that this paper was part three. Parts one and two were Sunstone sessions given in previous years, and I've been told that if you dig a little bit, you could find them. I would like to thank you for your interest and thank Bob and Dan for their preparation. Thank you. Thank you.